So that was a hard act to follow, by which I mean every talk since Monday morning till now. the only way I could imagine trying to concoct something appropriate for the final talk was to talk on some of Bill's last work, what I call Thurston's Last Theorem. It turns out that this is not Thurston's Last Theorem. In fact, Hanley showed me a paper on a that's under development. But this is one of Thurston's last big results. And it's the one paper that he almost finished completing writing. And it's now in print. It's in a volume of proceedings of a conference on the occasion of Milner's 80th birthday. And it's a tremendous effort by Milner, Sarah Cook, Lee Mosher, and many other people went into editing this into a final version. And it's a spectacular paper. And I can't do justice to the proofs, which are brilliant, and which were also presented by Bill at the BAMP conference and can be found in video. So let me say at the beginning that I'm not going to go through Bill's arguments because they're inimitable and they're already available online. The second thing I want to say is that it's a big mistake to participate in a panel on communication before your own talk. So I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed the Blackboard talks. okay, so Thurston's Last Theorem is actually it's a little bit like Fermat's Last Theorem, in fact it's three theorems. In fact, it's not three theorems. It's two theorems and one conjecture. And what I'm going to talk about is one of the theorems, and one of the conjectures, and then a variation on the second conjecture. The difference between Fermat and Thurston is that Thurston was absolutely clear on what he had and had not proved. Although there was often not space to write it up, but the statements and the proofs were available. So here is a theorem from Thurston's paper published this year. It's called Entropy in Dimension 1. So the theorem says the following. There's a there's a post-critically finite map of the interval to itself with entropy given by log lambda if and only if lambda is a Perron number. So first, let me tell you what a Perron number is. I'll give you some of the definitions in this theorem. So a Perron number is an algebraic number. It's a solution to a polynomial with integer coefficients. In fact, it's an integer, meaning the polynomial is monic. And the Perron number, lambda here, it's a real number, which is greater than 1. And the other roots of the polynomial, that is its Galois conjugates, are strictly smaller in absolute value. This is what it means to be a Perron number. And as we will shortly see, it's not hard to see that the entropy, whatever this means, is always a Perron number. But the converse is the main weight of the theorem. So what is a map of an interval to itself? Well, you can imagine it's a polynomial. It doesn't have to be. It could be a piecewise linear thing, a sort of multi-tent map. It's allowed to go up and down finitely many times. And when it bends, when it has a local maximum or minimum, I should say, this creates a critical point of the map. I assume that there's no points of inflection, that is places where the only critical points come from the map bending. They only occur at local maximum and minima. And then we assume that as you iterate the map on these points, that they all eventually cycle. Their forward orbits are finite. And so here's a simple example. This is the graph of the red is the graph of a polynomial. It's a map of the interval to itself. And the critical point is right here. And if you want to compute its image, you just go over to the diagonal and then up to the graph. And that's the image of the critical point. And you do that again, bounce back and forth between the diagonal and the graph. And in this case, after you've done that, I think 7 times, you come back to where you started. So that's what it means to be post-critically finite, a map of the interval to itself. And I find it kind of amazing when I first started learning this kind of theory, Kleinian groups, Teichmuller theory, etc., Thurston's great work, I considered myself a complex analyst, and I really didn't want to learn sort of combinatorial things and finite things. I wanted to take the d-bar derivative of an L-infinity function and do something with it as a distribution. And over time, I've come to appreciate every day more what Bill insisted that we do, which is first understand the combinatorial structure before getting into these distracting analytic details. And I thought, oh, well, there's not much to understand, right? Well, it turns out that there is. So this is the result. And now, let me tell you what my thesis is. No, I don't. There's probably some. I probably have some irreducibility assumption implicit in my hypothesis on the map. Thank you, Jack. I'm trying. I should say, somebody advocated in the panel that you should lie. And if you're going to lie from the first slide on. So there, the first of several lies has been detected, and I'm sure people will be kind enough not to draw attention to the remaining ones. Okay, so here's my thesis. It's funny, because with most talks, you give theorems, you give proofs, you give examples. But with Thurston's work, it's like talking about the work of Thomas Hardy or something, and you know, the theme of redemption. And I want to talk about how I see this theorem as fitting in to Thurston's entire oeuvre. Now, I don't know Thurston's entire oeuvre, except in a very superficial sense, but you all have gotten a sense of that, because there's been talks on almost every aspect of his work during this week. And here's my thesis. My thesis is that this result is an instance of what's called the H principle. And the H principle is something you may have heard of, you may not have heard of. I heard of it for a long time. I had no idea what it was. I assumed it was something you couldn't understand because it's so badly named. And if you look up a definition, you'll find something like, what it means is every continuous section of a suitable partial differential relation in a jet bundle is homotopic to a holonomic section. Well, that's from Gromov's book on the H principle. Here's my paraphrase. Given enough flexibility, anything that's not obstructed will actually occur. Okay, so Thurston's theorem says there's an easy implication that the entropies are Perron numbers, and conversely, there's no obvious other restriction on the entropy. And Thurston's theorem says, in fact, there is no other restriction. Given a Perron number, you can construct a dynamical system which realizes that entropy. Okay, now, let me give you some examples of the H principle to set the stage. So here's a very old one. People used the H principle before the name was invented. This one is due to Weierstrass. Riemann also had an example that wasn't quite right. There exists a continuous nowhere differentiable function. And this is commonplace today. But at the time, it was considered an amazing thing. And here's how you do it. Here's how Weierstrass did it. He wrote down a Fourier series. And so the blue curve is a little bit oscillatory, but it's still continuous. And then you start adding in more and more terms, and they ripple at a very small scale. And so so the limit is continuous because of uniform convergence. But if you make the rippling rapid enough, then the limit will be nowhere differentiable. And why wasn't this theorem obvious to everyone back in the day? It's because of the word function. What is a continuous function? Well, people usually didn't even use the qualifier continuous. It was widely believed that any function is piecewise differentiable. And it reminds me of, and this is going to date me, there was a tennis game called the Battle of the Sexes between Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King. And Billie Jean King was a top-flight woman tennis player, and Bobby Riggs was a hack. And Billie Jean King would hit like this hard two-handed backhand, and it was in the Astrodome, and Bobby Riggs would hit this lob that would almost reach the ceiling and then drop in the other court. And it's very hard to return. That's called garbage tennis, but in the biz, but it's within the rules. And the thing is, when you say continuous function, you're making very clear what the rules are. And you might not realize what you're letting in to the arena, what legal play includes. And legal play includes these wild-looking continuous functions. And so the point of the H principle is if you exploit the full flexibility of what's allowed under the rules, then actually the problem is easy to solve. In fact, the problem has many solutions in most instances. And the problem is not to show there exists a solution, but is to find some way to construct one. And there's so many that it's hard to construct one because you have to make lots of choices and you have to make sure you don't back yourself into a dead end. But in principle, it's not hard. It just requires sufficient imagination. This is something Bill had a lot of. Okay, here's another example. This is a more modern example of the H principle. A hyperbolic surface, by which I mean say a closed surface of constant negative curvature, embeds isometrically into R3. This is called the Nash-Kuiper theorem. I tried to find a picture of a negatively curved surface isometrically embedded in R3, and they used to be made out of plaster and circulated to many math departments. You're right, immerses, that's right. I should say isometrically into R4, but anyway. Let's pretend it's another lie, okay? But it's close to being true. anyway, either way, it's problematic. It doesn't sound right, because you take a sphere enclosing this surface and you make it as small as possible, and then it looks like it should be positively curved where they touch. But the embedding's only C1. And so you can't really compare the curvature. But I can't visualize this example, but that's because I don't know how liberal a C1 surface can be. And if you really deeply appreciate that, you will figure out how to sort of wrinkle the surface. So it's C1 but not C2. And that's the technique of this H principle. OK, here's another version, another theorem, very similar in spirit. This was due to Smale. The sphere can be turned inside out. As you know, there's movies about this. Thurston has his own way of doing it. What I want to draw your attention to is the method illustrated in Thurston's proof. You first take your round sphere, and then you put lots of ripples into it. You make it very wavy. And these ripples keep kinks from developing when you push the sphere through itself. Notice the similarity between this and Weierstrass's construction. It's as if you add in these very high Fourier modes, and they make the derivative very large, and in particular, they keep the derivative from vanishing, so the surface remains immersed. So it's similar, in fact, to the construction of a nowhere differentiable continuous function. Here's my favorite example. This is the first example of the H principle I ever learned myself. I went to IHES to do my thesis with Dennis Sullivan, and I sat down to lunch, and Gromov was sitting next to me, and somebody, not Gromov, explained to me this following theorem. There is an isometry of the two-sphere to the plane. And what does that mean? It means that this map has the property that if you draw a curve on the two-sphere, when you project it to the plane, it's probably immersed. But as a parameterized curve, it's rectifiable. Therefore, it has a well-defined length, and the length is the same. Okay. So if you project the two-sphere to the plane, it's a contraction. How can you make it an isometry? And then I finally appreciated the answer to this question, which is that you make the sphere out of gold foil, very thin, inflexible metal, and then an elephant steps on it. And now it's in the plane, and it's highly crinkled, And that crinkling has allowed the length of every curve to be preserved. And then, so I thought, oh, I should probably try to get some gold foil and bring it in and do a demonstration like Bill would. And that turned out to be very expensive. But then I realized, with a lot of thought, and this again, I feel like I'm channeling Thurston here. What Thurston often did is he reminded us that things that seemed abstract and tricky, like pleated surfaces, we've seen pleated pants. And maybe, in fact, this object is familiar. And then I realized it is familiar. It's just we usually see the opposite. We usually see the inverse of this map, or this map being undone. And so let me just show you. Here is the sphere, and here is its image in the plane. So when you buy Jiffy Pop, they're actually sending you a sphere that's been mapped isometrically into the plane, and then when you're done popping the popcorn, it's isometrically returned to its original spherical shape. Okay. Another famous example that's been discussed in this conference, a closed manifold, say, doesn't have to be closed, but that's the hard case, admits a codimension 1 foliation if and only if its Euler characteristic is equal to 0. There's lots of good pictures of foliations, but having done the Jiffy Pop, I tried to look for some in nature, and it turns out that geologists are very interested in what they call foliated rock. And here somebody's worried, maybe it's a singular leaf here. Anyway, you should imagine the foliation is going into the rock, so it's really a two-dimensional foliation of a three-dimensional space. And let me see if I have this name here. Yes. Oh, well, there's three names I should mention. I forgot to mention Lawson. So what's quite interesting to me as I research this result in preparation for this lecture is that just a few years before Thurston proved this theorem, maybe 3 years before, Blaine Lawson published an Annals paper in which he proved that the spheres of dimension 2 to the k plus 3 admitted codimension 1 foliations. Actually, Alberto Verhofsky is here. He used one of Alberto's own foliations plus an inductive procedure. He's missing most of the spheres, right? Powers of 2 plus 3. So S9, it was unknown whether or not the 9 sphere could be foliated. And then 3 years later, every manifold, in particular, every manifold of odd dimension, admits a codimension 1 foliation. Done. What happened? So one thing that happened was Lawson's construction is actually very beautiful and should not be considered as being superseded by Thurston's construction. It uses Milner's theory of fibered links and a beautiful generalization of the Riebe construction to higher dimensions. But you see, nobody... Rabe? So... I think Dusa said Reeb, so I'm giving her a break. So, the thing is, those constructions were essentially global. And Thurston's construction is essentially local. But what it does is it exploits the full flexibility of the incredible range of possibilities for a codimension 1 foliation. You're saying almost nothing about this foliation. It's smooth. Smooth functions can be incredibly torturously winding around and so on. And Thurston used the full flexibility. That is, he used the H principle to construct this foliation. Now, I want to share with you something I heard from frequently since I was a Harvard student and not a graduate student of Bill's. So there's a school of differential geometry, Atiyya, Bott, Herzebruch, Singer, etc. Yao is a current exponent of the school, where there are no pictures, occasionally the circle. and there are lots of partial differential equations. And the problem here can be thought of in the following way. You have a manifold, and it omits a codimension 1 plane field. So you have hyperplanes that you can draw in the tangent space at every point. The problem is that hyperplane distribution is not integrable. It's not locally tangent to a manifold. Now you just want to fix that. And once you've fixed it, you've constructed a codimension one foliation. So you want to get rid of the torque in the foliation. And people in this school tried to read Thurston's paper, and they tried very hard, and they couldn't get through it. And eventually, they went on to other things in differential geometry and, you know, Ricci flow and so on. And they would periodically ask, when somebody talked about Bill's work, they would periodically ask, isn't there just an evolution equation, like the heat equation, that will take this non-integrable plane field and sort of reduce the energy that's keeping it from being integrable, and it will flow to a sort of harmonic representative, which will then have no problem being integrated, and that will solve the problem. And we'll just write down this equation, and then, you know, that will be the real proof. And finally, I was at MSRI when Bill was chairman, the director, and Bott was in the audience, and Bill explained his proof of this theorem. And Bott stopped listening after 5 minutes, I believe, which shouldn't hearsay, but he waited till the end, and then he asked this question: why can't you just do this by some differential equation, then we would have a real proof? And Thurston immediately said, well, if it was a solution to a parabolic PDE, then it would probably, the end result would be a real analytic foliation. And my proof works for the three-sphere, and the three-sphere has no real analytic codimension one foliation. End of story. So in fact, you cannot solve this problem by that kind of mathematics. Okay, now, here's where we start to bend the rules even more. I claim, and this is my thesis, that there are combinatorial versions of the H principle. And it's not generally recognized, but here's an example that's relevant to Thurston's theorem. And Thurston's theorem itself will be a sort of combinatorial version of the H principle. That's my argument. So here's a famous result of Doug Lin, and it's used in Thurston's proof. It says, there exists a Perron-Frobenius matrix with spectral radius lambda, if and only if lambda is a Perron number. So again, it's a converse theorem. It's easy to prove. The spectral radius, which means the largest eigenvalue of a Perron-Frobenius matrix, is Perron. And conversely, if you give me a Perron number, I can find a matrix. So here's a review of what a Perron number is. What's a Perron-Frobenius matrix? It's a finite rank matrix with all entries non-negative, and some proper power of the matrix should have every entry non-zero. And here, of course, I'm asking for integer entries. Where is n? Oh, yes. There is no right? There's, you're given a Perron-Frobenius matrix. Every Perron-Frobenius matrix is in sub n. And take the set of all such over all n. Take your spectral radius, and then you get the set of all Perron numbers. So I think you're getting to a point, which is exactly the point I want to raise, which is, suppose lambda is, say, cubic. How big do you have to take the matrix which realizes it? So let me give you the idea of the proof. I think this may be the only proof I'm going to mention in this theorem. So how do you get to the matrix from lambda? So suppose lambda has degree d. Then you first construct an integer matrix that has lambda as one of its eigenvalues. So that's not hard. You take the companion matrix, for example. But this matrix will usually not have positive or non-negative entries. Like if the polynomial has various different signs in the coefficients, the companion matrix is not positive. Especially if the trace of the Perron number lambda is negative, that will equal the trace of this matrix. And so this matrix can't be positive. So how do you get to this Perron-Frobenius matrix? Well, what you do is you consider the dynamics of this mapping acting on the space of lines in RD. So we go to the projective space of RD, and we have this transformation. We have an eigenvector. That means we have a fixed point. And then the Perron condition says that that fixed point is attracting. As you iterate t, all nearby points are drawn towards that fixed point. So it's an attracting fixed point for this dynamical system. And now what you do is you construct a polygon, Q, maybe with many sides, such that this polygon is convex and it's mapped strictly inside of itself under this map. And this is easy to do because you see you just start with one point that's nearby and you start iterating and you take the convex hull of the iterates as you go forward and that eventually stabilizes. And when it stabilizes, it's a finite-sided convex polygon and by definition it goes strictly inside of itself. So it's almost trivial to construct this Q. And then you see this convex region is the set of points that can be thought of as positive linear combinations of these vectors, and what that and the fact that it goes strictly inside of itself means that if this is an n vertex polygon, then there's an n by n real Perron Frobenius matrix, and its eigenvalue is also lambda. It has this dynamical system on PRD as a factor. How big is n? N is the number of vertices in the polygon. Now, we haven't even made it integer yet. That's an additional step, but at least we made it real. How big did the real matrix have to be? Well, the number of vertices in this polygon. Here's an observation that emerged in a conversation with Linda and myself. Even if lambda is cubic, we may have to take n arbitrarily large. What's the proof? The action on projective space might be very close to an irrational rotation. And if that's the case, you have to take a lot of iterates before you get a polygon that maps into itself. The orbit is almost a round circle. And so there is no relation, no bound, in terms of the degree of lambda, on the rank of the matrix P. And that's why I say this is an example of the H principle. When I formulated the theorem, I put no constraint on P. And in the proof, I use that with great abandon. I don't care one iota how big the matrix is, as long as it's finite. And Danny, if this is about a lie, then...
This is cube complexes.
Sorry?
This is cube complexes.
This is cube complexes, was the comment. Yeah. Yes. Which, yes?
Is it obvious there's not like a slicker construction of a matrix that gives you a smaller n?
No, because to construct this matrix is identical to constructing this polygon. You see, to say that this matrix, let's go to the integer case. That's the important case. You see, if you have an integer matrix and it has lambda as one of its eigenvalues, it has all the Galois conjugates of lambda as an eigenvalue too. So that means that there's an invariant subspace spanned by those eigenvectors. And now you project to that invariant subspace and you see this picture. And the positive cone in Mn, which is mapped into itself, projects to give this polygon here. So in fact, that's the only way. It's not obvious, but that's the argument. Other questions? Okay, so this is kind of, you have to buy this, otherwise you won't buy my thesis. This is more or less the only proof I'm going to give. I want to say I think this can be considered as a combinatorial version of the H principle, a combinatorial instance of the same idea. And of course, the reason I say that is it's Thurston. Thurston was using the H principle all the time. I never heard him say the word. If I asked him if he was using it, he knew the word, but he wouldn't use it in his own discourse. But I think he was constantly thinking in those terms when he was proving theorems like this. And by the way, I want to draw a distinction between this kind of theorem and some of Thurston's other great works. For example, the geometrization theorem for Hawken manifolds. What's the difference? In the geometrization theorem, the hyperbolic metric is unique. Mostow rigidity. And you almost feel like Thurston was getting tired of these H principle theorems. They were too easy, even though they had annihilated subject after subject. He wanted to do something where the answer was more rigid. And so the geometrization theorem for rational maps, etc., are not instances of the H principle. But this final theorem, this theorem in his last paper, is. So anyway, here's the theorem again. And what I want to say is just a brief comment. Why is this true in the easy direction? Why is the entropy a Perron number? And the answer, which is pervasive in Thurston's mathematics and in our mathematics in dynamics, is because of Markov partitions. And more to the point, the answer applies to post-critically finite multimodal maps, but it also applies to pseudo-Anosov maps. When you have a pseudo-Anosov map on a surface, you can partition the surface into nice rectangles, and then they form a Markov partition. When you have an automorphism of a free group, you can realize it, if it's of the good type Wadham was talking about, you can realize it with a train track. Again, you get a Markov partition. And in fact, for pseudo-Anosov maps, if we're only interested in going forward, we might as well go to a train track. And so in fact, all three of these discussions are about one-dimensional dynamics. And I told Wellington DeMello this recently when I saw this paper, Bill, because I had never realized that these were all three the same subject. And Wellington has a book with Van Strien that's, 2.5 inches thick, called One-Dimensional Dynamics, and it is only about a third of the theory, namely about the theory of multimodal maps. In fact, it's almost all about unimodal maps. And the fact that these three subjects are unified was clearly transparent to Thurston, and it's transparent in this paper that was one of his last works. Okay, so here's a quick description of why the entropy is Perron. So I'm going to just tell you in a very simple case how to calculate the entropy. Tan Le did a more difficult case already. So this is one of my favorite quadratic maps. So here's a parabola. It maps the unit interval into itself. The critical point is here, and I've drawn the orbit of the critical point projected onto the diagonal. So it goes boop, boop. So it goes here, 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 and then back to where you started. Okay, so what you can do is you can use the points in the post-critical set to give a partition of the interval. Just cut the interval just project these points onto the x-axis and use them as endpoints of intervals, and you get two intervals, A and B. And because of the fact that the post-critical set is invariant under forward iteration, the image of A here, which goes from this dot to this dot, is the interval B. Well, it is the interval B. So this is, I'm taking A, I map it up onto the graph, and I get the interval B. In fact, it maps by a homeomorphism. But if I take the B interval, and I map it up onto the graph, well, it goes all the way down here, so it covers A and B. But in any case, the image of one of these intervals is a finite union of the others, and it maps to it by a homeomorphism. Yes? The third dot here ought to be up here. Yes, exactly right. So, yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm really sorry about that. Blackboard talks are way superior. thank you. Of course, now everything else is wrong, but. Okay, so what I want to say then is that if you start in A, you go into B, but if you start in B, you can either stay in B or go back to A. So we have this little directed graph associated to this dynamical system, and we can describe that directed graph by a matrix where A and B code the columns and rows, and you put a 1 in the matrix if there's an arrow there. And so that's the matrix describing this graph. The adjacency matrix is this guy. It's a Perron-Frobenius matrix. Its leading eigenvalue is the golden mean, and the log of that number is, in fact, the entropy of this map. Okay, so that's an idea of why almost any one-dimensional dynamical system which preserves a finite simplicial structure will have entropy equal to a Perron number. So this happens all the time. And I probably should say weak Perron, as Jack points out. But let me slough over that distinction and just say what we've said. So that explains why you get prone numbers. Now, how do you go back? How do you construct that from lambda? So that this is Thurston's main theorem. For any prone number, there exists a multimodal map that realizes that entropy. In other words, let me rephrase his theorem. You can take the entropies of multimodal maps of degree k and take their entropies. That's a subset of the real line. And you can take the set of all Perron numbers. And the theorem is that these two sets are the same. Okay, that's just rephrasing the theorem. So these are the ones that arise from F with k laps. That means the map goes up and down k times. That's the theorem, is the union of the MK is equal to the Perron numbers. And the proof begins with Doug Lin's construction. But what I want to emphasize about the statement, not the proof, but the statement, the formulation of the theorem, is that this is what I call a stable theorem. That is, we give up any attempt to control the number of laps. That's the great idea in the H principle. And it's being used here. We don't try to relate the degree of the Perron number to the number of laps. We don't even try. We've stabilized the theorem by allowing any number of laps. And what that means is that as we try to construct F, if we ever get stuck, we can just add in more laps and hope that the whatever problem was holding us back can now be leapfrogged. Yes, so a multimodal map is a continuous map of the interval to itself, which is piecewise monotone. That's the definition. You can imagine it's a polynomial. The theorem's true for polynomials. Okay, so I call this I just want to introduce this terminology. I call this a stable problem, where we don't try to control the number of laps. And the proof is, use Lin's theorem, and then be very clever. And you can see it on YouTube at BAMF. Okay, let me contrast this with a different question, which is open, which is unsolved, and might even be unsolvable in the technical sense. What are the entropies that arise from quadratic maps, from maps that go up and down once? I mean, go up once and down once. So let's describe just this part of the entropy spectrum. The critically finite quadratic maps give rise to a set of lambda. What Perron numbers are these? So it turns out, and this goes back to the work of Milner and Thurston, that this question has a very easy answer in a non-constructive sense. So here's a square from the product of the interval from minus 1 to 1 with itself. You draw a tent in this square in such a way that the slope of the sides of the tent is lambda. And that just means the top of the, sorry, this is, my proportions are probably wrong. Lambda is determining the slope of this tent. And now, rather than iterating a quadratic map, we iterate this tent map starting with its critical point, which is at the origin. And the theorem is that this number lambda is in M2 if and only if the origin has a finite orbit under this map. So you can test any given Perron number, right? You just start iterating it under this extremely simple piecewise linear map and see if the orbit eventually cycles. Well, how long should you run your program for? And no one knows. So this fact is almost a tautology, given the Milner-Thurston theory, that this is an equivalent condition. And it allows you to prove some things. For example, there's another class of algebraic number called the Pizot numbers. They're all contained in M2. But it's unknown, for example, there's a famous algebraic number called Lehmer's number. It's of a degree 10. No one knows whether it belongs to M2 or not. It's a specific number, and no one knows whether or not it belongs to M2 or not. In other words, we don't know any way, even for one specific number that I like very much, to give a certificate that the forward orbit is infinite. We know how to do that sometimes, but not in general. And so here's a question. Does there even exist an algorithm that in principle tests if lambda is not in M2? So this is like saying, is this set recursively enumerable? Is the definition of this set constructive or decidable? This problem is unstable. It's unstable because we fixed the degree. And we've now tied our hands, so we're not allowed to use the H principle. Look at all the trouble we've gotten ourselves into. This is something very important in math, asking the right question. Well, sometimes, you know, asking the right question doesn't always mean asking the interesting question, because this question is interesting. It means asking also the solvable question. And the stable questions tend to be more solvable, and the solutions tend to be nicer. And I think that's part of Bill's genius, is in this area, he knew how to ask the right question. Okay, now we come to the part of Bill's work which is like Fermat's Last Theorem, in the sense that it's not a theorem, it's a conjecture. And the question here is really, as this is historically what started Bill thinking about this problem. It's a conjecture, and it's a conjecture that goes back to David Fried, although there's a minor error in the way he formulated the conjecture. The conjecture is there exists a pseudo-Anosov map on a surface with entropy log lambda, if and only if lambda is a bi-Perron number. A bi-Perron number is an algebraic unit, so now its inverse is also an integer, with the property that it's a real number of absolute value bigger than 1, and its conjugates lie between lambda and lambda inverse. So unlike a Perron number, the conjugates also can't get too small, and you're allowed to have lambda inverse itself as a conjugate, but no other conjugates on the inner circle, and no conjugates on the outer circle except for lambda itself. And these are called bi-Perron numbers. I invented that terminology expressly for this conference. I hope they will be called bi-Perron numbers by someone else in the future. This is a stable problem, right? Because we don't put any constraints on the genus of S. And so you have a cubic number, you know, just construct a surface of genus a million and a pseudo-Anosov map on it that realizes its entropy. Unfortunately, Bill did not complete the proof of this theorem. It's left for us. It's a beautiful conjecture, and you kind of can see some of his mode of mathematical research in that he took this problem and he transformed it into other problems about the outer automorphisms of free groups and then about multimodal maps, and then he solved a variant of it, and we should take that solution as guidance, perhaps, in trying to address the general problem. So this is open. Okay. That's too hard for me. I'm going to finish by talking about a third problem, which is I call the minimum entropy problem for surface, minimum entropy. And the problem is this. We look for pseudo-Anosov maps on a surface of genus G, and we look for the smallest stretch factor that can arise. So we look for the smallest entropy pseudo-Anosov map, but now we fix the genus, and the entropy is the form log delta sub g. Delta is a bi-Perron number, and for each genus, it's known the entropy spectrum is discrete, so there exists a minimum. It might not be realized by a unique mapping, but it certainly, the minimum exists. There's only finitely many candidates below a certain upper bound. And this has a nice interpretation. It's the length of the shortest geodesic in moduli space, as long as you use the Teichmuller metric. So it seems like a fundamental quantity that we might want to try to understand. And notice that, unlike Bill, I'm not bold enough to try to understand the entropies of all pseudo-Anosov mappings. I like to start with little problems. I want to just find one map in each genus that I can understand, but I want it to be special. It should be the simplest pseudo-Anosov map. And how hard could it be to find that map? It has the smallest entropy. So its topological complexity should be as small as possible. So it should be just barely pseudo-Anosov. And there should be some simple reason why it's the smallest. And one hopes there's a pattern there. And if we can find the pattern, we can solve this problem. OK, so here's an example. I know the value for genus 1. The value for genus 1 is, well, the mapping class group is SL2Z for the torus. The hyperbolic matrix of smallest trace is the 2111, famous from its relation to the figure 8 knot complement. And its characteristic polynomial is t squared minus 3t plus 1. The largest root happens to be the square of the golden mean, not the golden mean itself. So we know the value for genus 1 because the trace is always an integer, and the smallest integer bigger than 2 is 3. Yes, the mapping class group is always orientation preserving. Why? Because it acts holomorphically on Teichmuller space, which we want it to do. Otherwise, moduli space won't be a complex manifold. So for me, the mapping class group always preserves orientation. Lano and Tifo found the smallest dilatation in genus 2. And it's a zero of this polynomial, which I want you to try to remember. T to the fourth minus t cubed minus t squared minus t plus 1. And I think those are the only two numbers which are firmly established. We have good guesses for some of the other numbers. And Lano and Tifo found a lot of interesting examples and conjectures for what the small dilatation should be in low degrees and under low genera and under various conditions. But these are the only two values we know for sure at the moment. So one problem would be to determine delta G for all G. I think that's an interesting challenge. So yes? Oh, it's due to Zarkov or someone? Sorry? Hammond Sung, okay, thank you. Are both of you here? I apologize. So I wanted to bring up, my attribution is, as Echo points out, incorrect. What I wanted to bring up, I didn't want to write down everything that Lano and Tifo did, but their discussion includes a proof of this, but it's not the original proof. They found a very interesting way, though, to try to attack this problem in low genera. Let me tell you something about what was already known about delta sub g. It's known that delta sub g is close to 1. It's 1 plus big O of 1 over g. And this was proved by Penner in 1991. And in fact, by big O of 1 over g, I mean it's bounded above by 1 over g, but it's also bounded below by 1 over g. So the log is approximately 1 over g. So quick way to say this is the length of the shortest geodesic on the moduli space of Riemann surfaces of genus G is about 1 over G, up to a bounded factor. So one thing you could do is you might say, well, what is that factor? What constant? What's the constant over G? So if you take this number and raise it to the Gth power, you'll get something that's bounded above and below. And in some investigations of fibered manifolds a long time ago, I asked if this limit exists, delta G to the G. And something quite interesting happened. So Echo Hironaka visited Harvard in 2009, and she looked at a specific example and formulated two beautiful statements. One is a conjecture, which is very easy to state. The limit of delta G to the G should be delta 1. So notice it's right. I mean, you start with delta 1 to the 1. And at the end, you get delta 1 to the 1. So it's plausible. And she proved that the limb sup is less than or equal to delta 1. So to do that, you have to find small dilatation pseudo-Nosov mappings in every genus. You have to construct infinitely many examples. And I want to mention that a lot of people have worked on this problem, and there's many variations of it. By Aber, by Dunfield, by Keen and her collaborators, and by more people who I'm going to mention in a moment. So there's a lot of people who have worked around this and made a lot of interesting contributions. Still, this conjecture is open. So just to give a hint of what that work is about, let me ask, where do these mapping classes of small dilatation come from? And we know the answer to that. They come from fibered 3 manifolds. And what do I mean by this? Well, if you have a hyperbolic 3 manifold that fibers over the circle, and its first Betti number is bigger than 1, so the rank of H upper 1 over with Z coefficients, the free part is of rank bigger than 1. Then, in fact, it fibers over the circle in many different ways. So this is a great idea. If you have a 3-manifold that fibers over the circle, or any manifold that fibers over the circle, you may be able to take the fibration and vary it slightly. For example, the torus fibers over the circle with the fiber, this loop. Here's the torus. But it also fibers over the circle with the fiber, this loop, which is in some sense a close approximation to a high multiple of the original loop. And that happens for all manifolds that fiber over the circle. If the rank of the first cohomology is bigger than 1, the classes corresponding to fibrations form an open set. And so you can move them a little, and you get lots of integral points, and all those integral points correspond to fibrations. So M fibers in infinitely many ways, and it turns out that when it does fiber, well, the fiber is a surface, usually a very high genus. There's a monodromy map, and that's called F. And the mapping torus of that monodromy map, that is, if we glue S cross I, take S cross I and glue the ends by F, the mapping torus is our original manifold M. So M can be presented in infinitely many ways as a mapping torus. And among these, F, there are many where the entropy is on the order of 1 over the genus of the surface. And this is actually a very easy observation. It probably should be attributed to David Fried, except he didn't formulate it. But certainly, if I had told him this, he would have said I knew that. So I wrote this down in 2000, but I think it was known much earlier. And but then there's a much more subtle theorem, which is, in fact, this is the only way to make mapping classes with dilatation on the order of 1 over the genus. So this is the theorem of Farb, Leininger, and Margalit in 2011, that in fact, if you fix a bound C over G and look for all the F which satisfy that bound, well, they all arise from finitely many 3-manifolds via this construction. In other words, their mapping tori give only finitely many 3-manifolds with a little lie built into the statement. Okay, so this is the only way to make examples. So if we want to try to study this conjecture, all we have to do is look at 3-manifolds that fiber over a circle and verify it one at a time for each of these 3-manifolds. So here is Hironaka's example. So what she did is she took the 2-1-1 matrix and observe that the mapping class group of a torus is the same thing up to its center as the mapping class group of the 4-times punctured sphere, which means that these mapping classes have to do with braids on 3 strands. And so if you take the 2-1-1-1 matrix and think of it as a braid, it's just the obvious right-left braid. And this is the simplest pseudo-Nosov map on the 4-times punctured sphere. You could say it's the simplest pseudo-Nosov braid. And now if you want to make this into a 3-manifold, what you can do is you draw this braid, and then you close it in the 3-sphere by just taking the first strand and tying it to the first strand at the top and so on. Well, then you get the unknot. So what you really wanted to do was to draw it inside a solid torus, and a solid torus is the complement of the unknot. So you throw this clasp in here around the 3 strands, and you get a 2-component link. And that's a 3-manifold with first Betti number equal to 2. And it fibers over the circle, because you see this 4-times punctured sphere here that spans this orange curve can just be pushed through the sphere and comes back to itself. As it does, the 3 strands of the braid give you 3 moving points, comes back to where it started, so it fibers. And once you have that vibration, you have infinitely many nearby vibrations. And so here, by the way, is a drawing of the same knot, same link. So you can see it's symmetric, that there's no real distinction between the 2 components topologically. And in my 2000 paper, I developed a method for calculating the entropy of all these different mapping classes that come from a single 3-manifold. And it's very simple. What you do is you when the first Betti number is 2, you draw on the plane, you put some integers on the integer lattice. And this is actually h lower 1 of the manifold, where I'm drawing these integers. And now what's a vibration? It's an element of h upper 1. So it's with coefficients in z. So it projects the integer lattice, z2, onto z. And what you do is you take the numbers that you've written down here and you add them up. You push them forward under that projection and add them up, and you get some weights on the integers. And then you think of those as the coefficients of a polynomial. And the largest root of that polynomial is the stretch factor of the Pseudo-Anosov map. Its logarithm is the dilatation. So let's try. Let's push forward by the simplest projection. And what we get is t squared minus 3t plus 1. This 1 gives the coefficient of t squared. These 3 minus 1s add up to minus 3. This 1 gives this coefficient. Yes?
Could you say where the numbers came from?
Oh, they come from a calculation. So there's a theorem that there exists something, which I call the Teichmuller polynomial. It's similar in spirit to the Alexander polynomial. It's associated to a fibered face, and it has the property that if you want to find the dilatation of any element in this fibered face, what you do is you take this multivariable polynomial, you push it forward to get a one-variable polynomial, and that's the characteristic polynomial of the stretch factor for that vibration.
Is there a way to say what it's counting, or like the
Teichmuller polynomial? Yes, there is, but not now. That would be a long digression. Anyway, this is what the main point I want to make here is: notice here is the square of the golden mean, here is the 2-1-1 matrix. But this is, and again, when I see this, I think Thurston. Thurston would say, you draw something in the plane, and he says, yeah, that's just the projection of a, and then he sort of would close his eyes. And you would see, you would try to understand what he was talking about. There was something lifting your naive picture. So here's a two-dimensional picture that lifts this naive picture. What if we project in a different direction? If we project in a different direction, we get a polynomial that looks like this. This coefficient gives a leading coefficient here. This one gives a constant 1. And these three, if we project at the right slope, give 3 terms in the middle. So you get t to the 2g plus 1, and then minus 3 terms in the middle. Coefficients tg plus 1, tg, and tg minus 1. I call this L sub 2g of t. And the amazing fact is that it turns out that most of the time, this projection, in fact, corresponds to a vibration by a surface of genus G. And this polynomial is giving the dilatation of the corresponding Pseudo-Anosov mapping. So, for example, L4 gives the minimal genus 2 example we saw before. So that shows, you see, that the golden mean and that this weird degree 4 polynomial, they're two shadows of the same object. They're cousins. And there's lots of other cousins. And these cousins give genus G examples with the property that the dilatation, that the stretch factor to the G is asymptotic to delta 1 in agreement with the conjecture. And the reason is very simple. This polynomial is almost the same as this polynomial. Just blur your eyes and make this into 3 instead of x. Put those two terms together and call them 3. X is small, so it's almost 3. And then you get this polynomial, and the largest root of that polynomial is the gth root of the largest root of t squared minus 3t plus 1. And so that's you know, there's some more data to fill in, because not every g works right off the bat, but that's the idea of Hironaka's proof that the limb soup is less than or equal to 1. Okay, so I can't remember how far I'm out of time, but I'm going to try to finish very quickly. The main thing that's left is lower bounds. So if we could just find lower bounds compatible with these upper bounds, we would be able to finish the proof. And So I started thinking about this in 2009, and I wanted to make up. Danny, you want to slow me down? You have your hand up. No, it doesn't even imply the limit exists. But I think we can make a sort of, there's a statement it does imply. It's not very attractive. And I think this much stronger statement is true. So, okay. So let me just finish by saying something positive rather than just giving more and more open questions. So I thought, like we're supposed to do, what would Thurston do? And so my idea was, let's make up an algebraic problem that might be easier to solve, because it's hard to find and manipulate pseudo-Nosov mappings, but it's easy at least to find matrices with integer coefficients. And so, and you see it's all related. You have a map of a surface to itself, it gives a train track map, it gives a Perron-Frobenius matrix. And there's something special about this Perron-Frobenius matrix. Why is the spectral radius by Perron? It's because there is a symplectic structure on the space of projective measured laminations. And a linear map that preserves a symplectic structure has roots that occur in reciprocal pairs. That's true whenever a bilinear form is preserved. The eigenvalues are invariant under t goes to t minus 1. So this is not an arbitrary Perron-Frobenius matrix. It's one whose eigenvalues come in reciprocal pairs. That's what I call a reciprocal Perron-Frobenius matrix. And we could ask, can we give a lower bound on the spectral radius of such a matrix? And the answer is yes. In fact, the minimum spectral radius of a reciprocal Perron-Frobenius matrix of rank 2g is the largest root of this polynomial. This is not enough to complete the proof, unfortunately. But it's a hint. It's a step forward. It shows that an easier problem gives rise naturally to this family of extremal polynomials that are coming from the simplest pseudo-Anosov braid. Okay. One remark. There's lots of graphs that correspond to these matrices. In 2009, I had an approach to do this, which would involve just sort of solving the problem for a large but finite set of graphs. And after hearing Nathan's talk, I don't know why I didn't just do that, because it's much easier than dealing with 600,000 links and finding hyperbolic structures on all of them. And, you know, here's, what, 14. So why didn't I do that? Well, one reason is that, in fact, there's a lot more that you have to deal with. It's still not 600,000, but each one sort of required a separate argument by hand. And and this is only some of them. But in 2013, I was able to complete the proof. And the way it works is that you associate to each of these thousands of directed graphs something called its curve complex, which is very it's easy to describe, but I won't tell you about it in detail. And it turns out that the curve complex is, there's only one curve complex associated to all of these graphs. And there's maybe 20,000 graphs you would have to analyze in general. And in fact, there's 11 curve complexes that need to be analyzed. And the curve complex carries all the information of the graph, and it allowed the analysis to be completed. And there were two very important steps for me that happened in those intervening 4 years. One was, I discovered there's a book by Cartier and Fawata written in 1968, which is a very complete analysis of this theory, and it's related to right-angled Artin groups. So maybe Danny's comment on cubulation should be taken seriously, more seriously. And secondly, there's a beautiful preprint by Joan Berman around this problem. She was working along very similar lines, and she quoted a result in graph theory, which is well known to graph theorists that I didn't know, and essentially says that you might as well use the curve complex instead of the directed graph. And putting those two things together, one's reduced to this finite list of examples, and you analyze them, and out comes the proof. And so, concluding remarks. In fact, there's three settings where this kind of argument can be carried out. There's the Teichmuller polynomial, which is used to analyze a single three-manifold that fibers over the surface circle in many different ways. There's the Perrone polynomial, which is used to analyze all the different directed graphs with the same underlying topological graph. And there's the Clique polynomial, which is used to understand the growth rate of right-angled Artin groups. So three very different sounding discussions, but they are all instances of the thermodynamic formalism. And if you look through the theory, all of the theorems that are proved here, the reason you can make progress here is because what you're trying to do is minimize the pressure, and pressure turns out to be convex. People who work in thermodynamics consider these discussions trivial because they're finite dimensional. By using the convexity of pressure, it becomes possible to address all of these problems constructively, and there's a lot of hope for progress. So can we, in fact, determine delta G for all G? I don't know, but I consider this problem semi-stable. I'm asking you to do it for each G, so you should say, give up, Kurt. But I'm asking you to find the minimum, and the minimum is the minimum of a convex function, so there's hope that it can actually be carried out. Well, I forgot, I think I've strayed from Thurston's last theorem, so let me return to it. So a few weeks ago, as I was preparing this talk, I saw Shakespeare's last play, which is The Tempest. And at the end, The Tempest's main character is Prospero, who is a man who's been stranded on an island and has acquired magical powers far beyond those of normal human beings. And at the end of the play, he gives a speech to the audience. And it's clear that this speech is not just the speech of Prospero, but it's the speech of Shakespeare to the world through the voice of his actor. And what he says is, he first says, "Now my charms are all overthrown." So he's about to leave the island and he won't have his magical powers anymore. "Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please." Now, Bill would never say this because he doesn't speak in iambic pentameter, and he doesn't use these convoluted inverse constructions. But what this says is that it's up to us to fill the sails now and carry the project forward. And I found out earlier in this conference what Bill really would have said, because he put it in an email: better for more people to be involved. It's a fun and interesting topic. Thank you. Yes.
When you were hearing Glynn's theorem, I think you got as far as real matrices, and then you got sidetracked. Can you say a few words about how you make that into an integer matrix?
Yes, it's not hard. It's a standard result. So, I could have chosen the vertices of that polygon to be rational. For example, if I find a real solution, I could just approximate it by rational solutions. That's one of the ways to do it. And then it's a theorem that if you have a semigroup in the additive group of Zn, if you have a semigroup cut out by rational inequalities, it's finitely generated. And that means if you take those generators and you take their images, you can re-express them as positive combinations of the original generators. And that gives an integral matrix with the desired property. And it greatly increases the rank of the matrix, because you go from the vertices of the polygon to the generators of this semigroup. And so that's an additional expansion of N, which is compatible with the H principle idea. Yes, Jack.
Your statement of the H principle reminds me of something that particle physicists have said for a long time. Anything that is not forbidden is compulsory.
It's So Jack's comment was, my statement of the H principle reminds him of something particle physicists have said for a long time, and by the way, I claim no originality, which is that anything that is not forbidden is compulsory. It should occur in our universe. And perhaps the same is true in the mathematical world. Townley? Ah, okay, so Tanley says, in Thurston's article, there's a picture where you see something that looks like a random walk, and what does that have to do with anything, and what was he trying to do there? And so maybe I can just conclude by sketching this idea, which is very beautiful and is pervasive now in dynamics. It has been used for a long time in the theory of interval exchange mappings by people like Smiley and Kenyon, and it's called the SAF invariant. The Saarnoux-Fati invariant. The idea is, if you have this tenth map, and you're iterating starting with zero, and the slope is an algebraic number, then the forward orbit of zero is a collection of algebraic numbers. In fact, if the slope is an algebraic integer, the forward orbit of zero is a collection of algebraic integers. Now, the ordinary integers are discrete. An algebraic integer doesn't necessarily generate a discrete subring of the real line, but if you take all of the different Galois conjugate embeddings of that particular ring into the real line and possibly the complex numbers, the images of the algebraic integers become a lattice. That's a standard construction in number theory. Now, if you have a map on a lattice, a dynamical system on a lattice, and an orbit stays bounded, it's periodic. Because there's only finitely many points in a bounded set. So what you can do is you're iterating this map, and you look at it not just at this one place, but at all the other Galois conjugate places. And if, let's say, there's two other Galois conjugate places, then what happens is the map seems to perform a random walk in R2. And random walks in R2 are recurrent. And this is a random walk on a discrete subset of R2. So if it comes back, if it is recurrent, then you have periodicity. And so there's arguments that about whether or not you should expect a given number to cycle under iteration of the 10th map, intuitions which come from this randomness. And that I think, is what Bill was alluding to. So let's thank the organizers again.